We begin this hour by getting on the phone line and welcoming in our friend Colin Fleming, who has also returned to form as well, back making that Bunker Hill Memorial his own. Hello, Colin.
Hey, how's it going? I understand you're in your cup.
Yes, indeed.
You're promoting that alcohol again. There you go, corrupting everybody.
It's
big day, nonetheless.
It's what we do here every single day. Yes, indeed. Well, we want to celebrate today the anniversary, actually a couple of days from now, of one of the great television series, my favorite show of all time, and you think maybe the scariest program ever broadcast on television, William Shatner, 55 years ago this Thursday, There's Something on the Wing, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet on the Twilight Zone.
Yes, and did a very young Rich Kimball see that live? No,
I was, it's funny you mention that. I have this sort of vague, cloudy, sepia-toned memory of staying up to watch The Twilight Zone as a kid, but I don't think it would have been the original episodes. I think maybe reruns at some point, but I have watched it countless times since. I own the box set. Every time there's a marathon, I'm there to watch it live, even when they edit them poorly, because I think it's the greatest show that's ever aired on network television. And there aren't many other shows from the 50s and early 60s that hold up as well.
Really? See, I can think of a bunch that hold up pretty well, and I would argue that a lot of the Twilight Zone episodes don't hold up that well because they're so dependent on a twist at the end. And once you've seen that episode and you know the twist, I think that kind of diminishes, at least for me, the enjoyment in re-watching it. But not so the case with what I consider the very best episodes, like Nightmare on at 20,000 Feet, where it's not really dependent on a twist at all. It's dependent on a kind of hothouse airplane atmosphere that bleeds into the soul / psyche of Shatner's character, in like this notion of, is what I'm experiencing actually real? And I think a lot of us have a version of that on a daily basis quite often now for different reasons, and no one will believe this guy. His wife has his best interest at heart, and she's basically just indulging him like he's a small, dull child. And the flight attendant is kind of like whispering into her hand, like, hey, Captain, look at this nut over here. And there's so much tension, and I think part of the tension with the episode has to do with that very confined space of the airplane, which mirrors that psyche where the walls are closing in on you. And when Shatner goes to look out the window, your heart is pounding pretty good in your chest over what you and he might see together.
Yeah, and you know, it works even with the somewhat cheesy special effects of the time. It certainly still works today, but if you think back to when it first aired, my goodness, how frightening that must have been for people when I think there were probably a number of people in America that have never flown on a plane when it first aired.
Funny when people mention special effects on films or TV shows from the 50s or 60s, like The Outer Limits, the so-called bear that would be the monster in those episodes. They do tend to run down the special effects. But you know what? Who's to say that an airplane wing gremlin doesn't look exactly like that? You know what I mean? It's like, what does it automatically have to look like? Is it just kind of like sheen and computery and everything? Well, maybe it's kind of like this raggedy sort of like stuffed animal / duffel bag of a creature that's out there tampering. I find that disturbing almost, that the effects are what they are, because it adds another element, especially now, I think, of the unfamiliar. Because you see so-called good effects, right, when you go to the cinema and it's someone in front of a blue screen. And to me, it always just looks like something cooked up on a computer. And, yeah, it might be like, oh, these amazing pixels, and you can't even tell. And it looks false to me. The way I think of the gremlin, the original gremlin, and Nightmare at 20,000 Feet is as hyper-real. It's not a word you hear very often. But when something is hyper-real, it's so real that it seems to transcend the real and look fake. And I think our nightmares, our paranoias, our daily fears, our crises of the soul all fall under the umbrella of the hyperreal. So I dig that little gremlin dude. And that little gremlin, he's able to be kind of like witty because his costume is so kind of low tech.
Yes.
Like he's just come into this world himself and he's looking back at Shatner. And the funny thing about it, and it's terrifying too, is the gremlin is every bit like is like Shatner. What the hell are you doing here, man? And Shatner's like, Gremlin, what are you doing here, little dude? Like they each kind of have a right to that place in that character's mind with just the glass separating the two of them.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned too, and I agree with you, not all the Twilight Zone episodes work, but that's one, and it has a twist at the end, but the best Twilight Zone episodes, I think, don't actually need the twist.
They don't need the twist, and you can rewatch them over and over again, because one of the great tenets of all sort of literature or film, whether it's Star Wars, like the first one, the 1977 one where they're hanging out so much, or whether it's Sherlock Holmes and Watson, the 221B, you have all the plot stuff, you have all the lasers, you have all the Moriartys, you have all the gremlins, you have all the aliens coming down to get what they can from man, but you need to have a high hangout factor where it feels like you are hanging out with these people. With Nail and I is like that, where you just kind of feel like, oh, this is cool, dazed and confused. You wish to spend time in the company of all of these people, even though you don't necessarily like them as a person, but there's sort of just an ease for you to enter that world, and then everything can build off of that. So Twilight Zone episode I like, for instance, that certainly fits this bill is, will the real Martian please stand up? And it's a bus, it's in the snow, bus breaks down, everyone goes into this diner, and you have that kind of sort of Bonhomius, we're all sitting around, this is cozy, it's snowy and cold outside, and we have to spend some time together here. Maybe it's Christmas, who knows? All these people are going somewhere, and they have to kind of be this ad hoc family or social club for a little bit, and then the paranoia turns out to be a real threat, but not the threat we necessarily think, infiltrates that kind of Bonhomius gathering.
Yeah, and the paranoia reaches a fever pitch in another great episode, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. Your typical suburban street, and a few little things begin to go wrong. The power goes out, cars start independently, and before you know it, everybody is turned against their neighbor.
The single most prescient Twilight Zone episode there is, maybe the most prescient American television program of that decade, of that time period. I could think maybe the British film, the British version of The Prisoner could be like up there as well. But yeah, you have like not much going on. You have kind of like effects wise, the car starts, it shouldn't start, someone's lights flash, someone says, hey, I saw you out late the other night. And the other person's like, well, I like to do this thing with my telescope. And all of this happens on this sort of quintessential small town American street, and everyone turns on each other relentlessly until they're shooting each other and bad things are happening. And then it's the best cutaway, it's all of the Twilight Zone. You cut to these two like aliens, and this one alien basically says to the other, it's like, see, jackasses. Yeah. All you have to do is do a few little things. These people are morons. And the other alien's like, huh, this is going to be awesome. It's going to be so easy to take over everything. All we have to do is like turn some lights off and on. And it's like, it's true. People, I guess it's maybe not like an opinion you're supposed to have, but most people are morons. And it seems to be like we're becoming more and more moronic all the time, and we're more quick to reach for something that we can deem as terrible and bad, and you're worse than me, and I'm better than you. And these aliens are just standing up there like at the top of the cul-de-sac laughing at these people down below. And it's like, it's this jape, but it's like this jape that is, at the same time, it's powerful. It's sobering. It's like, huh, that's pretty jocular, alien, sir, but you're spot on.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Now, maybe my favorite episode is one that's not scary at all, but it's one that meant a lot to Rod Serling, because as he got caught up in Hollywood and the pressure of cranking out a series on a regular basis. He longed to go back to his childhood, as people often do. And I don't know that that's ever been captured any better than in the great episode Walking Distance with Gig Young.
It's the first great episode of the series, really. I think it's the fifth episode to air. And it's just this guy, he's 36. And it's funny because at the time, 36, you were like middle-aged. Now, 36, you're just kind of like at the end of your prime, maybe even in the NHL, right? You can be winning MVP in the various sports. But it was a different era, of course. And he is put upon and he's stressed out with his life. This, I think he's like an account executive, something like that. And he ends up back in time in the town where he grew up. And it's based on pretty clearly this park near Rod Serling's house in Binghamton, New York, that had a carousel. And this particular park that the guy goes to in the story has a carousel. And it's really kind of cool, too. It's almost like postmodernism, isn't it? The way he meets up with his younger self. And he goes to his old house, and his parents are older, and his mom kind of freaks out. And his dad eventually believes his story, and he sees, like, his license and everything. And even the dad, who in real, well, I don't know if it's real life, but back at, like, this guy's normal point in time now, he's dead. So he's talking to, like, ghost dad, in a way, and the dad is still being parental. He's like, you have to go back to your time. This isn't your time. This is other you's time. And you can't meet him. That's like really going to cross things up. It's like a little Doctor Who-ish. And focus on not what was, but the small steps you can sort of take to eventually get the bigger things that are going to mean more to you in your life. It's causing you to have this sort of ennui that's sapping your soul, that's enervating your soul. And he takes his father's advice, and he ends up back where he started, basically. So in a way, like, plot-wise, what really happened, right? But it's such an ingenious story, because the plot is internal, largely, and then you have these cool conceits to hang it on. Think of it, you going back and seeing little Rich. there you are. You're like, oh, little Rich. What am I going to do? I can't be seen by you. It's going to mess up everything for both of us.
And the dad's got that great line. You know, he says, I don't know, son. Maybe there's only one summer to a customer. Ouch.
of a summer of, you know, I was on this hockey history forum, and this guy, I guess he's a professor, like in Edmonton. And it's funny because some of the best pros I see is by people who are like hardcore hockey aficionados. And he was saying that the 1988-89 season, which was Gretzky's first season in L.A., was the season that he remembers more than anything else that's like basically ever happened in his life, like his marriage, anything like that, because he was so locked in the way kids can be. And he was at like that perfect age. And I think when you realize something like that, that you had times like that in your past, it basically removes some scales over your eyes, like your internal eyes, that allow you to have not that summer you had before. That doesn't mean actual summer. He's using it kind of as a metaphor. But these different summers, maybe more abundant, wiser, more copper-hued summers than those sun-spangled summers of childhood. And it's very touching, and these two are never going to see each other again, and it's just it's heartwarming, but it's not treacly. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, you know, when you talk about shows from that time period that hold up well, one that appears every once in a while on cable around here, and it might have become one of my favorites from that time period because I never saw it when it first aired. Peter Gunn is another one that holds up awfully well.
Yeah, it's interesting that when you'd mentioned before that some of these shows can be dated, and some of the shows that do hold up really well, actually, are Westerns. Think about, like, Gunsmoke Wagon Train. There are things on Gunsmoke. Like, there's an episode, for instance, where Matt Dillon is taking a guy to be executed. He's going to be hanged, right? And Dillon gets to know him as they're going along, and he sort of starts to think that this guy's innocent. And then you realize that he is. innocent, and he saves like Dylan from getting like bit by a rattlesnake or something like that. And Dylan, who's just this upstanding law marshal, basically gives the guy a chance to get away in the night, and the guy doesn't. When Dylan wakes up, he's making him breakfast. It's very almost like Billy Budd by Melville. And they get to the place where he's going to be executed, and like the last shot is Dylan walking away, if the guy is dangling from a rope. And it's like, that's something that's so ballsy. You can do whatever you want to do on The Walking Dead, but I see something like that and I think, like, wow, that is really vanguard art to put that out there. You see some of that with Wagon Train and Wanted Dead or Alive, the Steve McQueen, not so bonanza, but Dick Van Dyke could be quite cutting edge in its comedy and its farcical, almost French kind of quality. So I think when people say you have this golden age of television now, I think a lot of times they say that because they have no experience. I don't think they're like television historians who sat down with The Outer Limits or Gunsmoke or the best episodes of The Twilight Zone. And also because film and literature largely suck so much right now. So it's like, okay, you're the default king of the arts. Thank you, Netflix, and I have a marathon. And I don't think it lives up to something like that Rod Serling program.
Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday here on Downtown. Visit his website, colinflemminglit.com. Always a pleasure, my friend. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.